Hello and welcome to the Conduits podcast series on humanizing investment. Inspired by Gillian Tett's book, Anthrovision, this series will focus on inspiring the next generation of investors to recognize the value of responsible investing. I'm Asha Ladd, Chief Investment Officer at Conduit Capital, and each episode I will be talking to a leading responsible investor in the impact space, getting to grips with each of their stories, understanding what led them towards their career in the space, and how they feel we can begin to humanize the finance industry. My guest today is Steve Oyer. Steve has had more than 40 years' experience in the institutional investing space, with a unique focus working collaboratively to enable aligned family offices in the responsible investing space. Mr. Oyer's global investment experience includes structuring and funding direct private equity deals with significant family offices and institutional partners. Today, Steve is CEO of IX Net Zero PLC, a publicly traded, permanently capitalized holding company listed on the Alternative Investment Market, or AIM, on the London Stock Exchange. Prior to this role, Steve was at Lazard Asset Management and worked in a variety of roles in the financial services sector, including interim management for a NASDAQ-listed company. So Steve, can you start by telling us a little bit about your career journey and your arrival to the responsible investing space?
You know, my career journey begins with working in our family business. I grew up in a small town in Northeast Ohio called Youngstown. And you know, it's an interesting thing when Bruce Springsteen sings a very sad song about the working man in your town. It was a steel town. And working with my grandfather, my father, and uncle in our business was really something that molded me and shaped me in my career. Just the idea that you could focus on something that would add value to people's lives. We had a lumberyard and a concrete plant and construction business. And it wasn't really just about the timber or selling parts or, you know, land or anything else. It was really about these people worked in the steel mills, they worked in businesses, and we actually created something that would enhance their lives. So that was kind of the beginning of my career. And then as the sad song from Bruce Springsteen goes, they closed the mills in Youngstown. And out of 17 cousins in my generation, only one lives there. And we all kind of had our own diaspora and moved into different parts of the U.S. And I evolved into going to work on Wall Street in 1982. And I know we're in a tough time for the Dow and the world indices, but the Dow was at 800 when I started. And everybody that had been in the business for a while said, it's never going to 1,000, kid. And, you know, markets always surprise and the world moves on. But it was that early idea of trying to look at how these markets, how the economy worked, all these things. And I studied history in college. I didn't study finance. And so I had this view that it was really people that changed things. And you find a few mentors along the way. And that's really what was the beginning of my journey.
Steve, you mentioned the mentors. I mean, that's actually really interesting to, you know, build your career off of them. Can you share more about how they inspired you in your career and how they helped you?
One of the first people that kind of inspired me and I was really taken to was John Templeton. And the first thing I saw was he really took a global view of the world. The second is that he really talked about the supply and demand of the markets. And what that meant, because he was focusing a lot on emerging markets, what that meant for long-term trends that would elevate people's lives through economic opportunity. And I thought he was brilliant. And I had the chance to go to a seminar with him.
A value investor.
Yeah, he was a tremendous value investor. Yeah. And I had a chance to go to a seminar with him, and I thought he's going to unlock the secrets of finance to me. And the one thing he said to us is he said, this is a tough business. He said, the tough part about the business is not losing your soul. And I kind of went, oh, this is really something special. And back then we didn't have computers, believe it or not. I brought my own computer into Payne Webber, which was the first firm I went to. We had Quotron machines. And I taped what he said on my Quotron machine. Don't lose your soul. And that really was somebody that, for the first time, was looking at the economics, the markets, finance, making profit for people, but having some value system that drove and was the character beneath every decision.
Yeah, and recognizing the power of human behavior in financial markets.
Yep.
That's definitely a powerful screensaver.
It was Scotch tape before Scotch screen tape.
The makeshift, the pre-version.
Exactly.
And so, you know, part of your career has also spent quite a bit of time with family offices as well. You know, obviously you've had extensive institutional investing experience, but also you married that with the family office experience. And you know, tell us how much of your own family has enabled you to relate to those individuals and how you've brought those two seemingly different pools of capital together for aligned missions.
Well, it's interesting because every family has a story. And we used to sit with my grandfather who founded our business. He was somebody that came over to the United States when he was 13 years old, classic immigrant story, built a business, provided for his family. And we'd sit at his home and listen and talk about the stories of the business and who had done what, which family in town built this business, how they did it, were they ethical, weren't they ethical, all the things that, you know, when it's an older generation, that really formed me. When I had the opportunity to meet with families of significant wealth, it was no difference. I'd sit there and ask them about their family. And it was almost a happenstance in my career that this, you know, was something that I got the opportunity to do. I was working for the Harris Bank in Chicago. And this is, you know, Chicago is a city where families created businesses and they built them. And we had a client that had built a wonderful business over several generations. And it was the late 80s and it was the time of buyouts, mid to late 80s. And all of a sudden they were going to get $1 billion wire transfer. And that was big money back then. And the bank said, oh, great, we'll invest that money for you. We're your trustee. And the family went, time out. We don't let banks invest our money. And that was the attitude of families back then. And it changed the whole kind of paradigm for us. And they said, okay, we'd like to delegate, you know, and hire third-party managers. And banks didn't do that back then. So we had to go to court and do a trust construction suit with them to allow us to delegate investment authority. But on the other side, we had to be able to look at, find third-party real estate managers, evaluate deals, look at international, look at all these things with them. And it really changed the way we looked at dealing with families. And it gave me the opportunity to be in the midst of something changing within the culture and the financial infrastructure that was needed to serve families, because they weren't quite institutions and they weren't quite high net worth individuals. And what it really did was one of my colleagues who started a firm called Family Office Exchange, Sarah Hamilton, she said, I wonder if we asked the rest of our clients what they would want if they'd tell us. Kind of a revolutionary thing to think about a bank. And we sat down and we talked to the clients. From there, it became, well, why don't we get them together and let them talk to each other? And that was in the late 80s, the first beginning of these family office conferences that you see today. Mm. And it put me in the position to go around and sit down and talk to these families about their story, their history, what they're doing, the kind of idea of what they wanted to accomplish with their money, and then come back and try and create products and services and opportunities. And what I really learned out of that was families wanted to collaborate. They wanted to work with somebody that were their peers and really not be sold investments, but collaborate and invest or buy things at their own discretion, their time, and their own due diligence.
And how unique is that, Steve? Because I guess, you know, I've seen from my experience here as well, I mean, particularly when we think about climate, that certainly starts to seem to be the paradigm of conversation in the climate space. You know, the family offices that want to back new climate managers together, for example, and they mm-hmm. want to spread that risk and they want to collaborate together or they want to look at deals together as well. So, you know, how much of this is the full cycle versus...
I think it is a cycle.
Yeah.
You know, the best financial products are those that are created out of real need in the marketplace, structural opportunity, secular long-term opportunity, not ones that are dreamed up in a product development meeting. And that's what families started to do. And my first experience was in the middle of a crisis. In the U.S., we went through a crisis in the late 80s, early 90s, that was the Resolution Trust Company, when all the savings and loans pretty much went bankrupt. And they used to, every morning, print out the night before all the deals that the Resolution Trust Company, the government arm, had on offer. And these were golf courses, they were office buildings, they were businesses that the banks that went bankrupt, the savings and loans, held the debt on, and they just wanted somebody to take it off their hands. Now, as a bank, we didn't create a product on that, but I had some really smart private banking colleagues that said, why don't we go talk to families and see if they want to do some of this and we'll finance it? Because we were a healthy, you know, great balance sheet, creditworthy bank that could still lend money, not a savings and loan, who had gone through that crisis and had to be bailed out. And all of a sudden, I was out there talking to families about buying an office building together, about buying golf courses, buying different assets that were out there. And that's the first time I saw families collaborate. Mm. But it was based on something coming out of a crisis where they could be opportunistic. Out of that were forged some really long-term relationships with these families together. I mean, I've introduced you to people, Asha, over the years where you've seen them. I've had relationships with some of these people for 25, 30 years, and they still talk to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, you know, they feel that you understand them and understand what they're trying to achieve, which I think is fascinating. And so, you know, clearly there's what seemed to be the conventional commercial investing space. How did you then move to the intentional impact investing space? And particularly, how did that lead you to the role at Net Zero PLC and IX Investments?
Well, the seeds of it really started with a relationship I had with a number of families that wanted to invest globally. And when I say globally, at the time, there weren't mutual funds that were easily accessible, you know, at scale for these families to invest in. And so we created a partnership with, initially it was 14 families, and then it grew to 25 and 30 families. And to get scale to allocate to third-party managers to go out and find the best, that partnership then looked at, you know, the managers did due diligence. And in those conversations were this idea of, well, some of them were looking at socially responsible investing. And they looked at investing overseas as something that was more fraught with the potential to invest in countries and in economic systems and in companies that really didn't represent the way they wanted to see kind of ethical investing.
So right? Can you give an example of that?
Yeah. If you're going to be investing in, at the time, Southeast Asia, Malaysia, some of the other countries, you actually still had systems where workers were not treated fairly. You had the beginnings of this move where everything was being offshored and the workers were being taken advantage of. You had these strange systems in some of these countries where they were actually run by dictators and families that controlled the assets, and you kind of didn't want to lean in and lend your support to that. It wasn't so much, oh, we're not going to do alcohol, tobacco, firearms, but it was at least at the beginning of a conversation. So one of the managers that we ended up hiring was a group in Glasgow, Scotland called Murray Johnstone. And they began to articulate some of the things that they had been doing to at least have a framework for not investing with companies that were bad actors, basically. And that was my first kind of enlightening moment. And then I had the opportunity to actually work with Murray Johnstone at one point in my career, and it became a real issue to do socially responsible investing. But that was essentially, you know, just public markets exclusion. But it started to make me think, was one company more, you know, virtuous than another company? Does it matter how a company treats its employees? And remember, this is in the days where you were coming out of leverage buyouts and all the things that were going on. And it began to at least shape the way I looked at how capital markets could influence the personal capital of people that actually owned the wealth.
So, you know, you're currently CEO of IX Net Zero PLC, also at IX Investments. Can you share more about that? What is IX Net Zero and what's its core purpose?
So IX Net Zero, as you said, we recently had the opportunity to list here in London on the alternatives investment market, the AIM market, and it is a permanently capitalized holding company. The company was founded in 2015 with the idea that families could collaborate and they could deploy capital at scale focused on top-tier returns but have measurable impact. Because if you look back to that moment when my colleagues Trevor Nielsen, Per Lindstrom, and Howard W. Buffett actually founded the company, you had this whole kind of duality where a lot of people thought, well, in order to have impact, you've got to have concessionary returns. The whole purpose was we can have top-tier returns. We can have competitive, you know, institutional quality deal flow that would also have impact because of the intentionality of the capital. If you're going to invest in energy, let's invest in things that are decarbonizing the planet. If you're going to invest in green real estate, do it so it's sustainable and it's affordable and it, you know, creates impact that will be long-term. And that was the genesis of it. And a few families got together early on. And then when I joined the company, we were able to scale it and bring in to what we have now is 40 significant families from almost 12 or 13 countries now that are our key shareholders. And that was the genesis.
I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, particularly that it marries having a permanently capitalized vehicle, either in an unlisted format or listed format, and then the ability for family offices to also provide capital and still participate. That collaboration is not necessarily going away. It sounds like it's still very much there.
No, it is. Even though we have the public vehicle, it's the deal flow that comes from the families. And you look at the way families invest. They can be opportunistic. And in the capital markets, you'd call that special situations. They can look at something and act quickly. And also they can be long-term and not have to sell just because of the ability not to harvest the yield from the investment or the gain, but to be fee-oriented. In our case, we can do the same thing that families do. We don't have an artificial timeline for when we have to sell an investment. And we're not focused on creating a fee income. We're focused on aligning our interest and aligning our values and creating that long-term enterprise value in a investment that we all agree on. And it's really morphed into two main areas. One is energy transition, and the other is sustainability in the built environment. And those are married really well together with the long-term intentions of the families and now the public shareholders that we have.
Yeah. And what I also like about that, you know, is at least the trend we see is when, family offices are considered, it's more thought about in, as you say, either investing in third-party managers and being more passive in a sense, or thinking about them coming at early stage venture. But actually Net Zero is more on the growth initiatives and actually has a scalable aspect to it, particularly in these two sectors.
Yeah, I think, you know, for us, we are not passive investors. We're not a fund that says, you know, we're going to buy this much of the company or we're going to control the company and we'll call you in 3 to 5 years and let you know how it's going. We actually lean in and we've created companies. Our largest investment is a company called Waste Fuel. That was created at IX Investments and IX Net Zero. And it's a company that focuses on sustainable transportation fuels. But it's not the technology and the, you know, idea of what's going on in that end of it. It's the ability to marry two things. It's taking feedstock, which comes from municipal and agricultural waste, and turning it into fuels that somebody can buy at scale. and doing it profitably. And if you think about that, you know, two ends of the spectrum, that's project finance. We're not creating something new. We're just using the tool to do something at scale that really changes the carbon footprint in land transportation, sustainable aviation fuel, and especially in shipping.
Yeah. So, there's obviously an elephant in the room. It's also, I guess fair to say, quite a unique structure as well to combine the family offices with the listed vehicle. But it has been a pretty tough time.
I mean, the markets have not been the friends of anyone.
No, and particularly
especially ESG.
Particularly ESG. And so, you know, obviously you listed in January, which is, I think, the start of where the conversations are coming out. At least I can admit I had friends from, you know, the traditional sector calling me up and saying, you know, behind closed doors, I just don't get this ESG thing. It's seemingly now diverging to, you know, traditional markets. What's happening? And then we sort of saw that, you know, get reflected in the volatility in the markets. And obviously the war in Ukraine has sort of compounded that and brought up a great conversation about ESG, its role in the financial markets. So you've been a first-hand recipient of that. And it'd be great to hear what your experience has been and in particular what it's been in relation to, you know, the responsible investing sector.
Well, I think it's a confluence of a lot of things that are happening right now. You know, the war was a catalyst for that conversation about can we stand by passive as companies and not lean in and have an opinion about what's going on there. And that was very important. That was compounded by coming out of the COP meeting in Scotland, where corporate leadership stood up and investment leadership and said, we're going net zero. We're doing this. And then the other side of the equation was that so much of ESG in the public markets had been buoyed by not being invested in the energy sector. And by not having exposure, portfolios were lifted. Okay. And all of a sudden you had this change in the economic, you know, cycle, and not being in energy really hurt ESG funds to a large extent. Now, that's an oversimplification, but what it did is it made people re-examine these
companies.
It's
quite a simple narrative as well, right?
Yeah,
so oil and gas is the antithesis of ESG in a sense. It's maybe helpful for creating ETFs and whatnot, but it doesn't help when it creates volatility.
It harkened back to just an exclusionary issue, not a solutions-oriented issue. You know, the idea that energy transition can happen just by avoiding oil and gas and going full on to alternatives, that's just part of the equation. For us, it's got to be the institutional approach of the industrial scale that these energy companies can bring to carbon capture, to some of the technologies. I mean, where does somebody go to build biorefineries, to people that have already done it? Where do you go to have the infrastructure to put new fuels into the market, into airplanes and into, you know, land transportation and into sustainable shipping? You've got to use the infrastructure that's in place. That's where the big change is going to happen. And I think that was kind of the missing approach. For us, it's always been about leveraging the system, but being intentional with your capital and focusing on exactly the impact you want to have. It's this idea of creating companies that are de novo, that, to use the Latin term, sui generis, you know, to be the first movers in putting capital into things that will decarbonize, that will be sustainable in the long run. And that's different than having a complex of funds, and forgive me, but putting lipstick on the pig and saying, now, you know, we sound like a philanthropy. A lot of the companies are hilarious because I'd make jokes with friends, all the investment companies sound like philanthropies now, right? And the corporations sound like philanthropies, and now all the philanthropies sound like investors because they were going to take their capital and their resources and put them to work, you know, in ESG and impact.
Yeah. And how was that experience about raising capital, you know, in this sort of interaction and this moving market in its view?
Well, it goes back to raising the initial capital from the families.
Yeah.
Going back 4 or 5 plus years, I would joke that there were 2 G's that would drive the meetings. One was generation and gender. And, you know, 1 G was generation, the other was gender. And if I was talking to the older generation, many times it would be like, oh, that, you know, ESG stuff, we don't do that here.
We make money and then give money away.
Exactly, exactly. We're you know, I'm going to make as much money as possible doing anything that is going to create alpha or create opportunity for my capital. But if there was a woman in the meeting, whether it was older generation or younger generation, that absolutely changed the way the outcome of the meeting happened, especially if it was younger generation, because all of a sudden there was this idea that the capital meant something now. What we did with it now meant something. And so flash forward, and now we're raising money as a public company in this very volatile time. And in, for a while, it was like having a deer in the headlights, talking to people that just come out of a very volatile fourth quarter in, you know, 2021, and seeing the IPO market where so much wealth had been created and so much, you know, lift had happened, and then seeing 90% of the market being down.
Yeah.
So what we were able to find was people that really believed in the long term. And we have some great shareholders that focus not just on what we can do today, but the way we're going to build businesses and create value long term. And I think that's the only way. I've never been able to chase things on the way up and make money for myself or my, you know, ultimate relationships. It's always been the old-fashioned way. You find something, you build it, and capital flows to it, and it changes things in the industry, and you build enterprise value.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's a, you know, philosophy that exists in the financial markets.
Yep.
Benjamin Graham, you know, thinking about value-add investing. So it's something that should resonate with the markets as well, hopefully, over time.
And people recognize it. I'm a big believer in technology changing, you know, the world for the better. It changed all of our lives, and it changes society. In order to really lean in, be a phenomenal technology investor, you have to take a different level of risk and a different time horizon. And that's not the focus of IX Net Zero. We do believe technology is there, and we have companies that have wonderful technology. But you mentioned it earlier, it's this catalytic growth capital that can leverage this marriage of institutional capital as businesses scale and the ability to grow the businesses and, you know, be the catalyst for that.
So, I mean, I just want to end on understanding more about you, Steve, and something to do to leave with our listeners with. So, you know, share with us, it sounds like quite a lofty thing to share, but or a personal thing, but I hope you don't mind. You know, what is the vision of the world you're seeking to live in and leave behind, recognizing we're mere mortals?
At the danger of being waxing totally philosophical.
Let's do it.
I do a lot of work with universities and younger people. And I look at things that the industry that I worked in for the last 35, almost 40 years, which is finance, is changing from the bottom up. It's this younger generation that wants to focus on sustainable finance. They go into this because they look at the world and say, well, I want to work on things that are going to change things for the long term. And that's what's, to me, giving me tremendous hope. You know, you look at some of the top investment banks and asset managers, who's changing things? It's people that are very diverse and don't look like me. It's people that are totally looking at the world through a different lens. They're using the same structural, financial, and other tools that are out there. The capital markets haven't changed. We haven't suspended the laws of capital. But what we have done is put people in the next seat and given the opportunity, and it's changing, that are going to use the system in a different way. That's what creates hope for me. You know, and I see that all the time, but I see it in individuals. It's not one firm out there. It's the people that are in the seat of almost power and almost, you know, leadership that are changing things. And there are very few, but more happening, people at the leadership that are at least saying the right things and opening the right doors. That's the hope I have. And then on a personal basis, going back to John Templeton, to have somebody of his stature look at a fresh-faced group of financial professionals and talk about ethics and value, to me, it's been about my own reference point from my own tradition. There's something called tikkun olam, which in Hebrew means repairing the world. That's what this is really all about. If there's any legacy, it's the ability to have your life have meaning in the people's lives that you've changed. And, you know, capital has the opportunity, and all of us in our positions, to build businesses and serve, be stewards of people's money, allow us to repair the world in our own way.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for sharing.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Humanizing Investment with The Conduit. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please do subscribe. To learn more about Steve and his work, please go to IIT's Net Zero's website. And for more information about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.